At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Podcast. I'm Connor Orr. Albert Breer is back from vacation, and I, like a vintage hockey player, am doing this down a tooth, which is wild.
See, you didn't even prepare me for that. Like, I didn't even know about this.
I wanted to hit you with that. I wasn't going to put that in the pre-show conversation. I wanted to just throw that out there.
So, like, I'm assuming this was, like, kid-related or no?
No. So, this is... I have a poor history of budget dentistry work. You know, when you come up in the newspaper business, you don't exactly have what some people would consider to be good health insurance or health insurance. And so sometimes you just get work done by people in kind of like these little office buildings that don't
by Dr. Nick Breer.
Yeah, it's not like a real dentist. And over time, once you actually do attain health insurance and you get it looked at, one dentist described my mouth as a series of mashed potato teeth. And so I got a root canal done not too long ago. And then, like, during the process of it, the dentist just completely shattered the tooth and then did nothing about it. And so I had a legitimate loose tooth for... like 3 weeks, which is a feeling I haven't had since childhood.
Right.
Super unpleasant. And
but I do sort of remember it. That's like something you don't forget. You know what I mean? Like what that feels like.
I know. And like I was sitting there, just like my wife was just like, stop thinking about it. And I was just like, I can't. Like every chew is one chew away from complete and total personal meltdown.
Right. And I remember you used to, I feel like you were always like a little paranoid you'd swallow your tooth.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like that was sort of like a big part of it. Like that, like it would come off at exactly the wrong time and then it would go down your throat.
Yeah. So that it's new.
I have had a root canal. Like I had really good dentistry when I was a kid because my grandfather was a dentist. I have had a root canal, and I will say that the hype is real. It really, really sucks. Mm-hmm. And I also have a fake tooth. I have a fake tooth here, which was a result of me and my brother throwing things at each other in the pool when I was like 8 years old and half my tooth getting knocked out by some sort of toy.
Wow.
Which was also really painful.
One of my front teeth is chipped from trying to open a beer bottle in college, and then I have...
You tried to imitate like the bottle opener mechanism.
I tried to go full Roadhouse, and then like in the back of your mind, you're like, girls will find this impressive. You know, that's
they won't admit it. They won't admit it, but they'll think it's really cool
to act like the kind of person they're trying not to become by going to college. I'm again committing a federal offense here. I'm stealing from Albert's mailbag, and we're going to answer a few pressing questions. We're taping this on Thursday on the eve of the sale of the Washington Commanders, which is a historic day because Daniel Snyder will soon no longer be able to create fun little blackmail PowerPoints and get the NFL in trouble anymore.
Right. This is like an interesting one because it's more about what a fan base is getting rid of rather than what they're getting, you know, which is... I think a little rare in these sorts of situations. Like maybe the Clippers would compare to it, right? With Steve Ballmer coming in and Donald Sterling going out however many years. The Mets, the Mets would be another one. There are few that are like this and where it's very much more about like what a fan base is losing rather than what they're gaining.
You did a big sort of breakdown on Josh Harrison. People can look at Albert's Twitter timeline and shared it again today. What is sort of your takeaway on Josh Harris? I mean, the 76ers have become what some would assume to be a model NBA franchise. They're consistently competitive. There's nothing, I mean, they went through their period of the process, which again, I think worked. I don't think it was a bad thing. They got a bunch of good play. They got some good players out of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. What was sort of your takeaway from that process?
Well, I think you have like a lot of the things that you're going to expect with any new owner. And that, you know, I feel like these guys come in and everybody thinks they're going to be like the Microsoft of the sport. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, and so like, every new guy without fail who comes in is like a big analytics guy. I feel I can't remember the last time there was a guy that came in that wasn't like sort of tagged as that. You know, Tepper was that. The Waltons are sort of seen that way. And so, like, I do think, like, you know, when you're talking about the process and everything else, there's, you know, he's seen what works and what fail, what works and what doesn't when it comes to that stuff. You know, one thing that was a big theme in talking to people, NHL wise and NBA wise that were around him with the Sixers and the Devils, they all said that he empowers his people. And so like, he's going to be tough on them and he may not like have the most patience of any owner in the league, but while you're in the job, you're going to be empowered to do the job at a high level. And he's going to invest back in the franchise, you know, and I think that's obviously a big part for any owner is, you know, when you spend that amount of money on the team, how much are you going to have to invest back into the franchise to make it what it needs to be? I think the big benefit here, Connor, is like a lot of these guys come in and because now they're almost all titans of industry and have been very, very successful, like outrageously successful in their lines of work, they come in and instantly think they're going to be the smartest guy in the room. And what are these imbeciles that I'm going into this room with know? And I'm going to be able to outsmart everybody. And, you know, I think it happened with Jimmy Haslam. I think it happened with David Tepper. And, you know, I don't think it's going to happen in this case because I think he's already been there and done that, you know, and he's already stubbed his toe. And so I think that part of it is a very real benefit is like the guy knows like sort of where now he still has to learn from an NFL context where those potholes are. But just as far as like general sports ownership, he's already stubbed his toe. He's already fallen in some potholes. Like he's already made the mistakes. And I think that should prepare him better to hit the ground running, you know, and you know, full disclosure, I talked to him last night. One thing that was sort of interesting, you know, talking to him about it was like how, you know, for the first 5 or 6 months, he really wants to be a fly on the wall. You know, and he wants to sort of observe what's in the organization and observe what Ron Rivera and Marty Herney and Martin Mayhew are doing on the football side and observe what Jason Wright's doing on the business side. So I don't think you're going to see many big decisions here over the first 5 or 6 months. But, you know, I do think that like he's going to take his experience having on the Sixers and Devils and a Premier League team, which the name of the team over there escapes me now, but he's going to take the, I think it's Newcastle. Is that right? No, Newcastle's the one that the Saudis own. So that's probably a bad one for me to, whatever it is. It's a team over there. I can't remember what they're all called, but
my list of soccer teams that I know begins and ends with Manchester United. I think there's,
I know
Manchester City
too.
Leeds. Yeah. Leeds was like popular when I was a kid.
I know
they
about
were sponsored
Fulham.
By Umbro.
I know about Fulham. Because
Fulham. Yeah.
Shad and Tony Khan. Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, so, but I think, like, I do think, you know, he'll be able to apply that experience in being that fly in the wall over the next 5 or 6 months, you know, and learning, you know, and learning about the franchise and what's gone right and what's gone wrong with it.
It's a super, it's an admirable approach, but I always laugh when I think about it in theory, right? Where,
yeah.
You know, like when Robert California comes at the end of The Office and yeah. No one can get a read on him and he's just watching everybody. And I think back to, I don't know, like my first job when me and some of the other interns would do like D-Generation X like stuff with each other or do like wrestling moves to each other in the break room. And okay, yeah, you're bringing in a new boss, so just like stop doing that, you know. And
yeah,
you know, it's not like you're gonna it's not like you're going to behave in the bad way that you were doing before. When a new boss comes in, you're gonna be like, oh ha, yeah, I'm just on my way here to do some work, just crunching some numbers. Wasn't at all going to throw an old sandwich at the back of the head of a coworker. But yeah, I mean, we saw
Well, maybe it's like Office Space, where the guy who really impresses him is the guy who doesn't change.
Like someone who not the worst of what happened under Daniel Snyder, but someone who's just like, you know, Josh Harris comes in the first day and he's like, well, what do you think about this, Bill? And he's like, well, I think we should continue lapping funds from country music concerts and stealing money from the NFL. And he's like, you, sir, have upper management written all over you.
Yeah.
Good work. By the way, I looked back at, I just did like a jokey thing that we're going to throw up on the website after the sale becomes official, and just look back at the series of controversies under Daniel Snyder, and I'm going to separate them into two categories. One being the heinously awful, toxic stuff that we've actually talked about, you know, and has been investigated and stuff. But even just the little things, you know, I forgot about the Washington mug with Washington State on it that was being sold at the team.
I don't even know if I know about that.
It was a logo with the W on it, and it was being sold in a team licensed truck outside the stadium. And in the background was the outline of Washington State instead of Washington, D.C. There were the, he sold the 9/11 hats, which were obviously not very popular and not really a savory thing to be throwing in the pro shop after on the fifth anniversary of the worst tragedy to happen to this country in a couple of
years. There was the Sean Taylor statue.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
that didn't go over very well.
My goodness gracious. So,
yeah, my favorite one, did you ever read the Washington City Papers? Like, anybody who wants to know more about this should read that.
Yeah.
The Washington City Paper, I can't remember how long ago it was. It was probably 10 years ago now, at least, but they had a rundown of all of it. And there was one that to me was like the funniest one, which was like, he basically got a safety ordinance passed in Landover, Maryland, where you couldn't cross the street on a Sunday because he was pissed that like the McDonald's and the gas station across the street were making money off of people parking there, right? So there's literally like a safety ordinance that went in that no one can cross the street on Sunday. So if you parked in one of those like lots across the street, you couldn't get into the stadium, which necessarily funnels everybody into his lot.
It's almost like he was raised and only got to watch the cartoons that featured like a comical villain. And then he's just like, oh, that's how you're supposed to act. You know, he just thought that was like standard operating procedure.
Like the guy who's constantly rubbing his chin.
Yeah, twirling the ends of his wax mustache.
Actually, you know what the better one was? This is when he first bought the team. I think it would have been like 99, 2000, whatever. And they had just signed like every guy who was like a Hall of Fame player who was like 5 years past his prime, right? It was like Bruce Smith, Deion Sanders. You remember this? Marty Schott. Like he went all in. He just fired Norv Turner. And I think they brought in, I want to say that was maybe Schottenheimer was the coach of that team. So he decides to come up with this brilliant idea to charge people for going to training camp, right? And it was like $10 a pop or whatever, and it was seen as like the greediest thing ever, which it was, right? But what he didn't do was he didn't read the rules, like the NFL rule book on it. And the NFL rule book showed that you could charge people to come to training camp if you wanted to. But if you did that, then other NFL teams could send scouts to your camp. So like the first day of camp, like there were scouts from like 7 or 8 teams at Redskins training camp.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in
like not just evil, but also kind of stupid. You know what I mean? Like,
it's the perfect combination. I'm a big believer in setting yourself up to look better than someone else, right? And so I think it was always a bonus to me when, like, especially when you were dating when you were younger, right? You didn't want to be the guy that followed up the entrepreneur or the military hero or the guy who left his high profile business job to give back and do Teach for America. You know, you don't want to be the guy after that because then you're the bad guy, you know? And
right.
Josh Harris is essentially stepping in for the worst, you know, in every markable, assessable way, owner in modern sports history? I don't know. Like, I don't, from
the guy who couldn't stop farting during dinner on the date.
Yeah. I mean, if Daniel Snyder were a dinner guest at his like high school girlfriend's house, it would be like the equivalent of like just walking in and immediately murdering one of the pets, you know? And then insisting on staying for dinner.
Honestly, and I know you've heard me say this, Connor, but and I tweeted it earlier today. I don't think there's any one figure in North American sports history. Now, I can't speak for sports overseas. I don't know it well enough. But I don't know that there's been any figure, one person in North American sports history that's done more damage to a franchise than Snyder's done to that franchise. I mean, like when I was growing up, when you were a kid, like they weren't the Yankees or the Canadians or the Celtics or the Lakers. But they were pretty close.
Right.
Like they were like right there. And that was the franchise of Joe Gibbs. And they won Super Bowls with three different quarterbacks. And they were a regional franchise. They had fans all over the South, right? Because the South didn't have a team for so long, you know? And you just think about like if I had say I take you back to like 1992 and I tell you this franchise is going to be a complete punchline. In 30 years, you would have thought I was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And here we are.
They are now like, you have to now claw your way back to get yourself above Jaguars, which was a tough hit in the power ranking, like the respectability power ranking. No offense to the Jaguars, who I think have actually done a pretty nice job of rebuilding their brand over the last you know, 5 or 10 years or so. What do you think is going to be the biggest immediate impact? Because what's interesting is when you watch the ownership change in Denver, it sort of played out the same way, but the patience and the sitting back and the waiting only extends to a certain period of time. And then it's like, okay, we're going to fire our first year head coach, which was a massive undertaking. We're going to sign Sean freaking Payton, who, you know, probably has to make in the neighborhood of almost $20 million a year. You know, you got to get up there to hit that number. And so, I mean, you have the power to massively reshape the NFL in a very short period of time. And that's one of those places where, like, they're going to get a new stadium built. Again, this is a year where we're talking about historical draft capital at the quarterback position. You just, the possibilities for him are endless. And they're, you know, as much as you want to be a fly on the wall here, some of the stuff you probably got to get a move on if you want to.
Yeah. And I mean, Snyder, like, set the bar so low. Like, it's like almost like Josh Harris is walking up to it and he has a chance to clear it by 10 feet. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, I think it's, I think the number one thing is going to be morale, right? And I don't think that this part of it can be underrated. This is really worn on a lot of people there over the, because it's been like a 2 or 3 year thing. You know, it really goes back to the pandemic in 2020 and, you know, the name change and then a lot of things coming out like on what was going on in the workplace. And obviously morale was bad before that, but there was this feeling that I think for everyone in the organization, this was hovering over them. Right. And like, I know for like the guys in charge, like Ron Rivera, Martin Mayhew, Jason Wright, like the message from those guys had been, let us handle it. You know what I mean? Like, you guys just do your jobs. But the reality is, if you're living in that environment, it's not great, you know? And so I think like the number one immediate change is going to be morale, right? Like, the morale should be better. And there should be some excitement going into the 2023 season, which I think should give the guys in charge now the best chance to make it. Whether or not they do, I think, you know, obviously when a new owner comes in, he's going to have his own ideas and you're going to have to be really good for him to keep you, right? Like, that's just the reality of it. It was the reality in Denver, was the reality in Carolina. It'll be the reality here. And then the second piece, I think, is the stadium. You know, like, I think that's probably the immediate thing, is that there were a lot of politicians that weren't willing to do business with Daniel Snyder and weren't willing to do business with the team that I think are going to be way more open to it now. And so, like, the idea of figuring out where that stadium is going to go, like how it's going to be built, I think that gets underway right away. And I can tell you this, like, one of the things that the other owners in the league really considered in this was how this isn't just a $6 billion price tag. There's also a couple billion that you're probably going to have to put into a new stadium, the ownership group is. So that's something that's already been considered, you know, and I think that's part of the reason why the ownership group is so big, because that investment is going to be part of it. So, you know, I think that those are the two things immediately. And then, you know, obviously, I think we get to the middle of the season, and that would be the next checkpoint. Like, if they're not very good, right? Like, which, you know, we'll see. But if they're not very good, do the changes come before the end of the season? What do we see them do at the trade deadline? If, like, the idea of Caleb Williams is on the table, remember where Caleb Williams is actually from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is Washington, D.C. itself. So, like, I think that's the other part of it, is if things don't go well, things could get interesting a little earlier than just the end of the season.
Jeff Saturday is always available to take over a head coach.
Who would be their equivalent of Jeff Saturday? I'd have to think about that.
like a Washington franchise legend.
Like a guy who's like, you know, like there's certain guys like that are like a bigger deal. Like, and Jeff was a great player, but like Jeff's a bigger deal locally in Indianapolis. Like he's one of these guys that like locally you probably overrate a little bit just because of the good feeling towards him. Maybe London Fletcher.
London Fletcher.
That would be a good one, I think, you know?
Yeah. I'm Googling. So this was part of the joke that I made in the Josh Harris column. I was like, yeah, one of the first things you could do is you could, you know, bring back some of the great players that you alienated from recent Commanders history. And I was just like, I don't know who that could possibly be because there aren't really a whole lot of good. Think about the last 10 years of Commanders football. Is Trent Williams has got to be far and away the best player.
Yeah, and he spent the last couple of years trying to get the hell out of there.
Yeah. So,
but right? borderline Hall of Fame player, right? Like, I would say he probably gets in at this point, right? I mean, I don't know, like probably.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But who else would you describe, let's say from 2010 on, as a transcendently great Commander?
I mean, I don't know, Ryan Kerrigan.
Right? Like,
I mean,
Brian Arakpo?
Yeah. Like you said, Trent Williams. It's a great question. Like, there aren't a lot. Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to like go through the positions in my head. You know, like some of the current guys, like Jonathan Allen and Daron Payne, but they're still playing, you know?
Yeah.
I guess Kerrigan like would be a good, because he actually is coaching, you know, like is like would be like somebody you might bring in that sort of interim role, you know. But yeah, there's not a lot.
I mean, it's grim out there. Kirk Alfred Cousins, Morris, player coach. Yeah, Alfred Morris, the one running back that was left in your fantasy football draft after you didn't do running back from 2000 whatever 8 to 2017.
Yeah, like Pierre Garçon.
Right. I mean, I would hope so. Shifting gears a little bit, you know, and we'll have more on this in the next few pods, obviously. We at your vacation, I feel like, Albert, was rudely interrupted by the discourse surrounding the running backs. And this is when you can tell it's a quiet time in the NFL, when we're rehashing something that is so painfully obvious. And okay, yeah. So Saquon Barkley, Tony Pollard and Josh Jacobs, but really Saquon Barkley and Josh Jacobs, both were pushing for those long-term deals mm-hmm. before the franchise deadline. Both will play under the franchise tag. Yep. All of them have now, there's reports of the secret veteran running group text thread of how they're going to try to, trying to fight their way back. I've seen a couple creative ideas pitched out there in terms of what they could do. I know that there was one, I think Jeff Darlington mentioned, give them shorter rookie deals so that they can hit free agency sooner.
And all these ideas, like I get it, you know what I mean? Like, but when have we ever seen all these rules are about control. The franchise right. tag's about control.
Right.
The fact that you can't do a second deal with a guy until after 3 years is about control. Like the longer rookie contracts for first round picks is about control. So what makes anybody think like the owners are going to do that? You know what I mean? Like you'd have to give something back. Like, and even I mean, I don't know. Like, you look at, like, so I do think, like, one of the things that was sort of underrated in the CBA negotiation that I thought the union really should have gone after, that maybe they didn't go hard enough after, was, like, the rules around the rookie contracts, right? But the fact that that didn't happen, like, with 7 years left in the CBA, I just don't know how people think they're going to convince owners to roll back something that's about their ability to control the workforce. They've shown us who they are over and over and over again. Control over the workforce is really important to them, you know? And it's just hard for me to see where, like, they make sense. And I 100%, like, I'd be all for some of those changes. Like, I think they'd be really good for players. They'd be good for, it'd be good for the value of that position. But I sort of feel like it's just kind of like a little bit of a pointless exercise to even dive into that part of it, because I just don't think the owners have ever had any sort of appetite for changing rules that they had put in. I mean, even like to me, like, the ultimate example is the marijuana rules. Like, who the hell wins when someone tests positive for weed?
Right.
Right? But they weren't going to give on that until they got something back for it. Like, that's a logical thing. That's legal in half the country now, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a logical thing. Like, the player, when someone tests positive for weed, the team looks bad, the player looks bad, the league looks, like, ridiculous for testing for it in the first place. So who the hell is winning? And yet, like, over the last, like, 5, 6, 7 years, there's been, like, all this push and pull on it. Like, no one cares if, like, the starting right guard for the Raiders smokes weed, right? You know what I mean? Like, so I just think it's like, I just think, like, what we've seen from owners in the past is that they won't give on any of these things, especially when it comes to their ability to have control over their players.
Do you want to know what my plan for Saquon Barkley? I sent it to him in a rambling Instagram DM, and I have yet to get a response. So,
okay,
here's what you do: you show up, you pretend everything's totally fine, which he has not done already. So already he's not following the plan. But you show up and you pretend everything's fine. You go through training camp. You act as a willing and able participant. Obviously, they're not going to play you in preseason games anyway. So, you know, halfway through week one. In the middle of the game, you inform the coaching staff that you are now only a third down back, and just be like, hey, I'm not going out there anymore. You're paying me a third of my value, which I wanted a 3-year deal. You gave me a 1-year deal. You're paying me a third of my value. I'm only going out there on a third of the downs. And if you say anything to reporters, I will pretend that you summarily benched me for no reason and I don't know why, and it will drag out throughout the course of this season. And the only way to
That's
fix
kind of
this
genius.
Problem,
it, right? Then you would limit the wear and tear, and like, yes. Yeah, and you'd probably still like be flashing what you are, right? Like, you'd have enough opportunity to be really showing who you are. I like it. I kind of like
all
it.
All around the league, everyone's gonna be like, why the hell aren't they playing Saquon Barkley more? He's gaining like 6 yards a carry. And every time Saquon Barkley does an interview, he'd be like, I have no idea. I'm ready to play. And then meanwhile, like every time the Giants put him in, like to try to put him in on first or second down, he's just gonna be like, no, I'm good. You guys didn't think I was worth a 3-year
contract.
Kind of like
it.
So.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I just think it's like, it sucks because, you know, you look at like someone like, and I think that this is an element of it we haven't talked enough about, which is that like Josh Jacobs and Saquon Barkley are coming off of big years, both of them, right? Both those guys have been through injuries. Both those guys have a lot of mileage. Both those guys are going to have a real problem getting value, like the proper value, if they hit the market next year, because Josh Jacobs will be going into year 6 and Saquon Barkley will be going into year 7, and that's ancient for running backs, right? Mm-hmm. We saw what happened in the free agent market this year with running backs. So like it would really, I would, one thing I think is like really interesting about it is that like both those guys were so central to what a first year coach and a first year general manager were doing last year, right? So central to it. How does that resonate with the locker room?
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, oh, that's the guy you screwed?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, that guy? Like, that guy who's been a perfect teammate, who has fought through injuries, who did everything you asked for, who you leaned on last year, that's the guy who isn't getting paid? And I think, like, we always pay attention to this. I always pay attention, like, when a new coach comes in, a new GM comes in, who's the first guy they give a big contract to?
It's always, I think that's that,
because usually
franchise guy.
Usually, yeah. You see it, usually it's somebody who has, like, not only is a great player, but it's somebody who, like, sort of represents what they want to build, right?
Matt Rhule and Christian McCaffrey, speaking of running backs.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so, like, you sort of wonder, is that going to work the other way? You know, and I don't think these two situations are identical. Like, I think the Giants one probably got a little more contentious. But, like, in both cases, like, I think that that's part of the risk you run here is, like, you know, like, how does that resonate with the players in your locker room?
I wrote this a couple of weeks ago, and I don't understand why these franchise tag negotiations always follow such a similar pattern, which is the team places the tag, the player refuses to sign the tag, then there is months of sort of this anonymous tip for tap back and forth from the team, and then the player will do like a charity appearance and just be like, yeah, no, I'm happy to play elsewhere. I don't have to show up for training camp. And we do the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, and then they cram negotiations right up to the deadline. And inevitably, when you behave that way, there's a winner and a loser in this, right? Either the team wins and the player's upset, or the player wins and there's resentment on the team side. Why not just, like, keep an open dialogue throughout this process? And if you're the team, just let them win just a little bit. Just like I feel like that is a cascade of goodwill that extends throughout your organization.
I'll actually give, you know what? I'll give the Cleveland Browns some credit here, okay? Because I do think, like, look at Andrew Berry's background and look at Kevin Stefanski's background. You look at, like, how those guys, like, the position they were put in by Jimmy Haslam, right? Like, and why Jimmy Haslam hired them and what Andrew Berry had worked on and the areas he'd worked on in the past, you know, and all of that. Doesn't that, like, isn't that, like, flashing red lights, Connor, right? Like, these guys will not pay a running back. Like, it looks to me like if you're like just looking at them from the outside, it's like, these guys are never going to pay it back.
Sure. Analytically driven. Right. Yeah.
And they paid Nick Chubb.
Yep.
And why did they pay Nick Chubb? Because Nick Chubb was so important to that team and they knew it. Right? Like, they knew, like, this is not only, you know, one of the best players on our team, one of the best players in the league, but, you know, like, he is really important to our identity. He's very well respected in the locker room. And so we want to show the rest of our team, this is what we reward. This is who we reward. Same thing with, like, the Titans, you know, like, and Mike Vrabel and John Robinson making the decision to pay Derrick Henry. Like, you could make the argument in both those cases, like, oh, that was stupid. Why'd you pay a running back? Well, you did it because the guy's really important to your team, and he's an exception, right? And you're going to go outside the box. And again, the Browns went way outside the box of the way that they probably normally think to do that deal. And, like, how much did it really hurt in the end? They gave Nick Chubb $12 million a year. Freaking Cortland Sutton makes $15 million a year in Denver.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, what did they give? Hunter Henry makes $12.5 million in New England. Like, when we're talking about these numbers, it's don't pay a running back, don't pay a running back, don't pay a running back. There are cases where it's like, no, we're going to go out, we're going to reward this guy, and it's going to have a good residual effect on what we're trying to build here. And in the end, it, like, costs us half of what, like, Devontae Adams cost the Raiders. You know what I mean? It costs us half of what Tyreek Hill cost the Dolphins. So it's not like we're going to get to 3 or 4 years from now and be like, whoa, like, that one really cost us. You know what I mean?
Saquon Barkley is going to make less than Adoree Jackson next year.
Yeah,
so,
that's the thing. Like, that's the thing. I had somebody from the Saints point this out to me. Like, this was 5 or 6 years ago. I was at their training camp, and this was like when Michael Thomas and Mark Ingram were really rolling, right? And, you know, it's a guy who's been in the league forever, and, you know, he's front office for the Saints. And, like, we were just, you know, we were talking about, and I think it was, like, right around when the Thomas deal was getting negotiated. And, you know, he said to me, he's like, isn't it kind of crazy that, like, Michael Thomas is going to make, like, three times, four times as much as Mark Ingram? I'm like, not really. And he's like, well, think about it. How much does Mark Ingram touch the ball? Like, how much of our offense is revolving around Mark Ingram right now? I think this is before Kamara was on the team too. And he was like, so much of what we do is based on like what Mark Ingram does. He's like, but we don't pay him like it. And it was like a really interesting point. Like, and he was making the point like to kind of explain, like, we think Mark Ingram isn't just a good investment. He's a great investment. And it's something that no one would tell you to do and pay a running back, you know? So I think sometimes we think of these things as too, and maybe too straight line of a way, you know? You're not really looking at the numbers. You're just looking at the position. And I think there's a way to look beyond that. You know, and again, like I think Austin Eckler made the point on Rich Eisen's show that like he's making what a number three receiver makes.
Right.
You know, he's making what like a backup quarterback makes. Like that's not a bad investment, regardless of what position he plays.
No, I'm surprised that with the Giants it went down that way. And I guess you could argue that the reason they brought in outside help was that they behaved in such a way that put them in a bad spot year over year after year. And you could accuse the Giants, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. It's just not always a competitive advantage. Was they were over loyal to a lot of guys for a long period of time. Like I remember covering that team, and when they finally decided to let Justin Tuck go in free agency, that was shocking. You know, when they let Hakeem Nicks go, it was mind-boggling because it was something that you could never really see the franchise doing.
Well, Saquon, the Mariners pride themselves on being like good people. You know what I mean? Like, and like this is a family business, and we're old school. We're not like these sharks that are in the league now. Like they've always sort of Like you covered the team. Like I've always felt like they've prided themselves on that. You know?
Yeah. And for whatever, and again, I'm not faulting them for using the mechanisms of business at their disposal to help them run a better ship in terms of efficiency, in terms of what they're able to spend somewhere else. But I always just wonder if there is that goodwill factor that, I don't know, you throw him an extra $2 million a year, you guarantee a second year of the contract, and even if he's bad, he's going to sell a lot of jerseys and there's going to be people there that come to see him. And I mean, who else, if you're a kid, who else do you know on the Giants? Like you're a fourth grader, right? And you live in the shadows of MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey. Who are you emulating on the practice field right now? Mark Glowinski?
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing is, like, their best players are, like, linemen, right? Like, other than Saquon, it's, like, Andrew Thomas and Dexter Lawrence. Yeah, I mean, like, it's guys up front, you know? I mean, there's reason to be excited about, like, Evan Neal and Kayvon Thibodeau, but that's not, like, like you said, like the kid who, you know, the 8-year-old who's throwing the ball to himself and he's Daniel Jones on one end of it. And who is he on the other end of that? He's Saquon Barkley, right? Like that's that. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely that element of it. And, you know, again, it's tough because he's had the injury history and, you know, you'd always say, well, the mistake was not paying him earlier. But in this case, I mean, you know, earlier when he was eligible for a contract, he was, you know, I torn ACL and, you know, he was going through a lot of different things that prevented it from happening. And so I think that like circumstance also played into all of this and getting to a point now where it's like, you know, if we're and a big part of, I think both with Jacobs and Barkley was like guaranteeing out into year two and year three. And in the case of Barkley, it's like, yeah, now he's got a lot of injury history, and you know, if you're talking about year two and year three, that's his seventh and eighth year in the league, which again is pretty ancient for a running back.
Yeah, last one we're gonna put on your plate here that I stole from the mailbag. Hard Knocks is back. They essentially like kidnapped the Jets and threw them in the trunk and forced them to agree to do this. I don't know a franchise who wants this less right now than the New York Jets, possibly in Hard Knocks history. They are probably the most willing non-participant. Now, today, right before we started taping this, Robert Saleh came out in an I Love Hard Knocks t-shirt. He said that they had some meetings. Everything's good to go. It's constructive.
All good.
He is a very zen individual. Yep. He's always going to take the high road in spots like this. But, I, you know, for me, my thought process is, and this is what I kind of wrote earlier in the week, is we're past the point where teams owe Hard Knocks anything, right? At this point, Hard Knocks is paying for the privilege of getting into the NFL space. And beyond that, you guys are like any of us, right? Like, we show up to training camp and we go to interview a player. There is no onus on that player to be interesting, engaging, truthful, responsive. They aren't owed anything. And so I don't understand why, and I wonder if this will become sort of a barrier-breaking moment for the show where it's just like, okay, so if you want to shove me on this thing, I'm basically just going to stick you with 8 hours of the Yule Log. You ever watch the Yule Log at Christmas time?
I've never watched the Yule Log.
You haven't watched the Yule Log?
I need to check that out.
Do you know what the Yule Log is?
No.
It's like a channel, and now Netflix has it. So you have to pay for the privilege to watch the Yule Log. But it used to be on like public access where it was a channel during Christmas time that was just a log on fire in the fireplace.
Oh, I've seen that before. Yeah, okay.
Yule Log. Yeah, and then they would play like, you know, White Christmas behind it or something like that. Yeah.
Does it have the crackling too?
Like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Nice.
Absolutely.
Nice. Yeah, I don't think like... everybody should check out the column you wrote because I thought it was really well done on how they don't owe anybody anything. I do feel like it's sort of like our NFL teams at capacity as content creators now. And I remember there was one team. This was I don't know, 6-7 years ago, and you know, I knew some guys that gotten fired from that team. And they used to refer to the team because, you know, they questioned the owner's priorities. Well, this is we used to work for a content company that happens to have a football team, you know? and that team was always seen as very forward thinking as far as like creating content and everything else. And now I feel like every team's sort of that way, right? Like where they employ so many people that, you know, are doing social media stuff and that are doing the in-house video stuff. And a lot of the in-house video stuff's outstanding. Like the Colts draft series every year is great. You know, the Jets have their own series, like, which is really, really good. And like, I do know, like, part of the way part of the problem, the Jets, you know, for the Jets here was they felt like they were at capacity, you know, like they felt like with everything going on with Aaron, with everything that we're already doing, with our in-house stuff, with all the national media that's going to be coming through here during training camp, with, you know, the increase in local media and local interest because of what we have here, it's just you're already at the point where you're jamming 10 pounds of you know what into a 5-pound bag,
right?
You know, and now you're going to put more on all of our people to be de facto actors in this show. Like, no. We don't want it. Like, we already are doing enough, and we're already at the point where it feels like we're doing too much. And I don't know that there's ever been a team, and like ironically enough, like the last one that might rise to this level was the Jets themselves, like that has been in this sort of high profile spot before without Hard Knocks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like normally, I sort of feel like it's a run of the mill team in a run of the mill year. Even when the Cowboys have been in it, it's like, I mean, maybe like the 08 Cowboys, I think they were on it, right? Like the 08 Cowboys, there was a lot of pressure on that team. But this is rare that you, and the Cowboys are sort of built for it, but this is rare that you have like the market size, the pressure that's on the team this year, and then you're throwing Hard Knocks into that mix too.
It used to be, right, if you're a crappy franchise who needs to prove that you're not crappy anymore, and that you can make some sound decisions, you would do Hard Knocks. Or, if you were owned by Jerry Jones, you would do Hard Knocks.
But it's PR, but it's like the teams don't need the PR anymore because they can generate it themselves.
And
you know what I mean?
The other thing, too, is this is my take on Hard Knocks, right? It's a great thing, but it's really, it's purchased access, right?
Yep.
And then you had, your first subject was the friggin' 2001 Baltimore Ravens. Perhaps one of the most personable teams in NFL history. Like
Ray Lewis, Rod Woodson,
Shannon Sharp, Tony Saragusa. Like, okay, you know,
yeah, Billick is the coach. You know what right? I mean? Like, yeah.
And I'm not, you know, yes, it was awesome, and they did a great job. But you know, even if you didn't, if you just left stationary cameras around that place and it offered no editing, that thing would have been brilliant. You know, and the same goes with their other probably most famous season, as you mentioned, 2010 Jets. Again, you had Rex Ryan. I mean, this guy is a master orator. He is one of the most famous public speakers of
you had the Revis NFL negotiation.
You had the Revis thing. You know, it. We can do as good a job as possible, but when do we do the best? At best, in quotes, at our job, when something massive is happening, or when we're interviewing someone who is already inherently interesting, right?
Right.
You know, there's a few exceptions.
We always, to some degree, have to draft off of other people's success.
100%. Yeah.
And that's the job. You know what I mean? Like, that's the job. And I think the other thing that's, you know, like, the other thing that's sort of interesting here is, you know, where, you know, like I don't know what this is going to. I don't know where this is like gonna what the next steps are for this show, but like it feels to me like the access has been pretty good, and we're probably looking at it now more from a 2023 standpoint, right? Because we've seen so much now. I wonder, Connor, maybe this is a story idea for us. If you went back and you watched the 2001 Ravens season, what the access looks like?
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like if we went back and watched it now from like a 2023 like standpoint, like does the access kind of suck actually?
Yeah,
and it was just awesome at the time because we'd never seen any of that stuff.
Yeah,
you know, like I sort of wonder about that. Like, are the early seasons considered so good just because like? We just didn't have any access, and we didn't have every team bombarding us with this and that and all this stuff to watch. Like, I don't know. Like, I bet you to go back to the 2001 Ravens season, you might think they really didn't let them in anywhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know. Maybe they did, but like, maybe I wouldn't be shocked if you went back and looked at that and said, we really didn't see a ton there. You know?
I mean, it was mostly like, what? Didn't they fill somebody's car with popcorn and then. There was the one rookie who just made fun of Shannon Sharp, and you know, there was like
they did the rookie show, which the rookie show, like no one thinks the rookie show is that hilarious anymore when they put it on Hard Knocks. But when we saw it for the first time, it was awesome.
It was
funny.
You
know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm with you on that. I think
that might be a good story idea. We gotta shoot Mitch a text here or something.
I was when I worked for NFL Network, and all my bylines were somehow mysteriously eradicated from that site, and some of them are replaced. There's a story that I wrote, by the way. I'm just going to rant for just a second. It's a story that I wrote for NFL Network that they have given another person's byline to.
Like, oh no,
it's wild. But anyway,
was it like an editor or a web producer or something?
No, but anyway.
oh, you don't want to say the name.
But anyway, I went back and I watched every single, episode of Hard Knocks up to a certain point. And I wrote like the absolute most hilarious things that, in hindsight, they're completely ridiculous. And I like, for example, like Herm Edwards standing up with the 2007 Chiefs and just like saying very, definitively that Brody Croyle is the future of this franchise, you know, like stuff like that, which was, you know, just looks very amazing in hindsight. So I'm always willing to go back through and watch some old Hard Knocks.
You'll get a young Joe Douglas in that Ravens season too.
Yes.
As the Turk.
Wow.
Yeah. He was the Turk in that season, which is like, it all comes back around now. Like now the guy who is the general manager of the team, that's like the first hostage, right? Like not a volunteer, a hostage in Hard Knocks history was the Turk in season one.
Wow. By the way, I'm for not show. And I think other teams have actually done this too. I don't think the Jets are the first, but I think we can stop showing cuts, mentioned, right?
Yeah, like somebody had mentioned to me that they haven't shown them more recent, like in the more, like I don't really recall, but somebody had said like, oh, well, that just shows that, you know, you haven't been watching the last few years because the last few seasons they haven't shown the cuts. which I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think we're past that as a society where we need to, you know, see someone's lives get completely shattered.
I mean,
you know,
I know, I've talked to coaches and general managers who I believe like they have like the chance to watch the show on Monday night, right? Like, because I think it comes out Tuesday, right? And then they have final edit on it so they can take stuff out. I mean, I would assume, like, to some degree, they probably run it by the I would assume like they at least run the cuts by the player and say, hey, are you okay with this being in here? You know what I mean? I would hope so, at least.
Yeah. The last thing I'll say in this, I was talking to one coach about this, and the coach said, like, a couple years ago, I was approached by Hard Knocks, and I said to them, or I told them, someone to say to them, that, like, if you put a camera on my field, anywhere near my practice, I will spend every waking hour of my life editing out any piece of interesting content, and this will be the worst season of your show in history. And that person ended up getting out of it. Now, again, the coaches have edit power over this, but I'll end it on this. I like Robert Saleh, right?
Yeah.
This guy has got to deal with Aaron Rodgers. He's got to deal with Zach Wilson. He's got to deal with managing the expectations for Sauce Gardner and Garrett Wilson. He's got to blend a team together. He's got to create a culture. He's got to do all this stuff. This guy probably sleeps for 3.5 hours a night in his office, and now you're going to ask him for another hour and a half of that time to edit your documentary,
like,
to make sure that
nothing legal
screws
pad.
Him over? Forget
like,
that. I'm sorry.
Sitting there with a legal pad, like, writing time codes down?
Yeah. Come on.
Yeah. That's... Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know. The final edit thing too does make the Browns season more interesting.
I will say that too.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it does make that Cleveland Browns season just a little more interesting.
Did Hugh? Yeah, like,
you know what I mean.
Like, go back and watch that again, and then imagine Hugh Jackson watching that footage and being like, "Yeah, this is how I want to come across."
Put that in.
Yeah. Keep.
I said, leave it in. Are you sure?
Oh well, thank you, Albert. As always, this has been fun. We're ready for an NFL season, buddy. It's here.
Yeah, it is. It is. Absolutely. Summer's over.
The MMQB NFL podcast is produced by Shelby Royston. Mark Mravick is the emeritus editor of the MMQB. Super Bowl champion Andy Benoit and Rec League basketball three-point assassin Gary Gramling are the founders of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts. And once you do, leave a rating and review, because it really does help other people find the show, which you can also find on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.